Imagine spending, I don't know, $10,000 and 2 weeks of your very limited vacation time to go sit in absolute silence on some freezing mountain in Tibet.
Yeah, just to find yourself, right?
Exactly, to escape the noise, only to realize, well, after reading the source material we are looking at today, that you could have achieved a far deeper, more permanent spiritual awakening while sitting in bumper-to-bumper traffic on a Tuesday morning.
It is a pretty striking contrast. I mean, we are so accustomed to thinking of spiritual transformation as something that requires like an escape hatch from our daily lives.
Totally.
The assumption is that you have to step away from your inbox, your commute, and your mortgage to find any sort of clarity.
And we are pulling our insights today from Roger Barron's 2025 book, The Temple Within. Barron is essentially decoding the rather dense 20th century esoteric teachings of a philosopher named R.S. Clymer.
Right, he makes it a lot more accessible.
He really does. And the core mission of this deep dive is to look at Clymer's concept of the great work. Okay, let's unpack this. Because the pitch here is that you don't need a guru, you don't need an ashram, and you don't even need to retreat from the modern world.
Which is such a relish to hear, honestly.
Right. The ultimate laboratory for your transformation is your own mind, operating squarely inside your regular 9-to-5 life.
Yeah, Clymer's philosophy is rigorously pragmatic. But to even grasp how this operates, we have to start with how he completely redefines human nature.
How so?
Well, the traditional narrative, especially in Western thought, often starts with a deficit, you know? It suggests that you are fundamentally flawed.
Like broken or sinful.
Exactly. And that you need to seek outside yourself for salvation or fixing. Clymer throws that out entirely. He posits that at the absolute core of your existence, you possess what he calls a dormant germ of divinity, or a divine
A
spark.
divine spark.
Yeah. The specific term he uses is the inner Christos.
I want to pause on that term divine spark because for a modern listener, that sounds a lot like poetry you would find on a motivational poster.
Oh, absolutely. It sounds like a bumper sticker.
Yeah, it's very easy to brush off as a nice, comforting metaphor. But reading Barron's analysis, it seems Clymer isn't speaking metaphorically at all.
No, not at all. He treats this spark as a literal structural reality of the human condition.
Like a biological fact.
He treats it as a spiritual fact, yes. It is as fundamental in its own domain as the laws of physics are in the material world. It is your true self, your unconscious soul.
Wow.
The issue is that in most people, it remains entirely unawakened from birth to death. So the entire goal of human existence, according to this system, is to awaken it to achieve a state he calls Christhood or soul consciousness.
Which sounds like a finish line, like getting a PhD or a knighthood.
You would assume so, but that is a common misconception. It is not an honorary title or a permanent rank you achieve so you can finally just relax on a beach somewhere.
Right, unfortunately.
Yeah, it is an active, continuous, highly disciplined process of becoming. It is a verb, not a noun.
That makes me think of an acorn.
Oh, I like that.
Because the acorn isn't a failed, broken oak tree that needs to be fixed. The complete potential for a massive, towering oak is perfectly encoded inside that tiny shell.
Yes, the blueprint is already there.
Right. But if you just leave an acorn sitting on a concrete sidewalk, nothing happens. It has to be planted. It requires a very specific environment, sunlight, and water to actually activate that code. So if the listener have this divine spark, this acorn, what is the actual mechanism that waters it?
The mechanism is a tool you are using right now. It is your mind.
Just the mind.
In Clymer's framework, the mind is the active awakener of that embryonic Christos. But he makes a very careful distinction here. The mind is not the soul itself.
Okay, so what is it then?
The mind is the architect and the builder. He describes it as the womb in which is born every thought and desire. It is the fertile space where the raw materials of your reality are generated.
I am struggling with this mind as an architect or like gatekeeper idea.
Oh, come.
Well, the book suggests the awakened mind has to catch thoughts at the exact moment of their birth, nurturing the constructive ones and actively rejecting the destructive ones.
Right.
Practically speaking, my brain is a chaotic place. There are thousands of random thoughts firing off all day long. Wait, so the mind is just a gatekeeper? Are we supposed to be intensely policing every random thought that pops into our heads? Because that sounds incredibly exhausting for the listener.
It sounds impossible if you view it as a game of mental whack-a-mole, where
Exactly.
you are frantically trying to squash every negative thought as it pops up. But that is not what Clymer is advocating. He introduces a specific practice called formology.
Formology.
Yes, which is the science of mental imaging. Formology is not about fighting the negative. It is about holding a clear, unyielding blueprint of a spiritual ideal.
So how does that actually work in practice? Let's say I'm in the middle of a stressful day and a deeply anxious or petty thought bubbles up.
Instead of fighting the petty thought, which actually just gives it more energy, you immediately redirect your focus to the predetermined blueprint of the ideal you are trying to build.
Okay, so you just pivot.
Think of it like laying down a completely new track for a train. In the beginning, yes, it takes conscious, deliberate effort to switch the tracks when the old habits try to take over.
Because the old tracks are so worn in.
Exactly. But over time, focusing the mind steadily on a constructive ideal makes that higher level thinking a natural reflex. The goal of formology is to discipline the mind to the point where the struggle disappears, replaced by an established, automatic habit of constructive thought.
Okay, I see. You aren't suppressing the chaos. You're just systematically starving it of attention by focusing on the blueprint.
Yes, starving is a great way to put it.
But if the mind is just drafting the blueprints, there has to be a physical construction phase. I mean, a blueprint doesn't build a house on its own.
True.
How do these mental blueprints actually manifest into the reality of a person's life?
They manifest through what Clymer outlines as a cyclical triad: thought, desire, and action.
Thought, desire, action.
Yes, this is the engine of human experience. Mm-hmm. Thought is the genesis, it is the alpha. But a fleeting thought has no power on its own.
Right.
When a thought is sustained and nurtured in that mental womb we discussed, it matures into desire. Desire acts as the bridge.
The bridge between the mental and physical.
Exactly. It provides the incentive, the emotional heat, and finally that desire forces action, which is the physical manifestation, the omega.
That sounds remarkably like a machine learning algorithm.
Oh, that's an interesting comparison.
Yeah, because when you train an AI, it takes an input,
yeah,
runs it through a set of weights and biases to determine importance, and produces an output. But the crucial part is that the output then feeds right back into the system to adjust the code for the next time. It trains itself.
Yeah.
Is this triad a closed loop like that?
That is a highly accurate way to frame it. It is a self-reinforcing loop. The actions you take create consequences and vibrations that feed directly back into your subconscious mind.
Wow.
And that cements the weights and biases of your character. Every cycle permanently alters the architecture of your inner temple. This is why Clymer emphasizes the extreme danger of weak or base desires.
Let me use another analogy. It's like a car. Thought is the steering wheel setting the direction. Desire is the gasoline in the engine. And action is the rubber actually hitting the road.
Perfect.
But what happens if we put bad gas in the car?
Right. If you feed the algorithm corrupt data.
Exactly.
Precisely. If the desire driving your action is rooted in selfishness, greed, or malice, it doesn't matter how polished the final action looks to the outside world.
Oh, so the intent matters more than the result.
Yes. The internal algorithm has been fed corrupt data, which leads to spiritual degradation. But when a desire is purified, when it is guided by wisdom rather than impulse, it evolves into what Clymer calls will.
Will with a capital W.
Exactly. Will is the highest, most concentrated expression of the divine within you. And this brings us to a concept he calls the spirit of the deed.
Meaning, the emotional vibration driving the action is what actually matters, not just the mechanical action itself.
Consider two people donating the exact same amount of money to a charity.
Okay.
One does it out of a profound sense of empathy and a desire to alleviate suffering. The other does it entirely for public praise, or maybe as a calculated PR move to cover up a scandal.
Right. Same action on paper.
On paper, the physical action is identical. The charity gets the money, but spiritually, internally, the consequences are wildly different.
Because the inputs were different.
Yes. The first person has reinforced the architecture of their soul. The second has merely fed their ego, feeding corrupt data back into their own algorithm.
This brings up a massive practical hurdle for the listener, because we are human beings living in a high friction world. We all have bad gas sometimes. We all experience that corrupt data.
You certainly do.
We all feel anger, greed, resentment, jealousy, or naked ambition. If we are supposed to act on those destructive desires and we aren't supposed to play whack-a-mole to repress them,
yeah,
what do we do with those destructive desires? Just repress them anyway.
Clymer's answer to this is perhaps the most crucial mechanism in his entire philosophy.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
The answer is never suppression. Mm-hmm. If you bury a volatile energy, it just festers and eventually explodes, His solution is spiritual transmutation.
Transmutation, like alchemy.
Exactly. This is an active alchemical recycling of your inner energy. To understand it, you have to look at how he strictly divides passions from emotions.
I noticed that in the text. We usually use those words interchangeably, but he treats them as opposites.
Completely opposite. In his vocabulary, passions are electric, degrading, destructive vibrations.
Like what?
This includes malice, hate, uncontrolled lust, and ruthless ambition. Emotions, on the other hand, are etheric, uplifting vibrations. Things like love, courage, forgiveness, and devotion.
Okay, I track that.
The great work involves taking the raw, chaotic horsepower of a base passion and actively converting it into the exact fuel needed for an ennobling emotion.
So it's less about being a saint who never feels anger, and more about being an engineer who knows how to recycle toxic waste.
That is a brilliant way to phrase it.
Or like a martial artist using their opponent's momentum against them. You don't hate the energy of your anger.
Yeah.
You harness it, strip away the malice, and use that intense heat to fuel your courage or compassion. Let's ground this in a real scenario for the listener.
Okay, sure.
Imagine the listeners at work. They've been putting in 60-hour weeks, carrying the team, and they just found out a colleague who barely does any work but plays office politics really well, got the major promotion instead of them.
Ouch. Yeah, that happens all the time.
Right. And the immediate natural reaction is intense, burning anger, and probably deep resentment. How does spiritual transmutation work in that exact moment?
First, you acknowledge the intense heat of that anger without judging it. The energy itself is just fuel. It is neutral.
The energy is neutral.
Yes. The poison is the malice attached to it, the desire to see your colleague fail, or the urge to secretly sabotage the project. Transmutation requires you to cognitively strip that malice away. You refuse to feed the destructive narrative.
But you still have this massive reserve of heat, this raw horsepower.
Exactly. So you redirect it into will. You take the intensity of that anger and use it to fuel a ruthless, constructive audit of your own skills.
Mm.
You use it to power the courage to have a difficult professional conversation with your boss about your trajectory. Or you use it to fuel a disciplined job hunt for a company that actually values your work ethic.
You're using the anger.
You are taking the exact same physiological energy that could have made you a bitter, toxic employee, and you are using it to build your competence and self-respect. You are transmuting the lead of your lower nature into the gold of your higher nature.
Which is brilliant because it completely reframes negative emotions. You stop fearing your own anger or ambition. You start looking at them as free energy resources.
Yep.
But this level of constant internal alchemy, monitoring the algorithm, transmuting the toxic waste, holding the blueprint, it sounds like a full-time job. If the listener is spending all this time transmuting their soul and guarding their thoughts, do they have to go live in a cave? How do they pay rent?
Clymer is very clear that abandoning your material life is actually a failure of the great work.
Really?
Yes. He operates on what he calls the law of balance or equilibrium. He wholly rejects the tired trope that you have to be poor, suffering, or detached from society to be truly enlightened.
Well, that's refreshing.
True success requires a harmonious integration of both the material and the spiritual.
So he's directly contradicting the monk on a mountain idea we talked about in the intro. He's saying the boardroom is just as valid a spiritual arena as the monastery.
He argues it is the primary arena. Clymer frequently points to historical misinterpretations of religious texts to make this point. Take the concept of mammon, for instance.
Oh, yeah. Usually associated with greed.
Right. Culturally, we've been taught that mammon simply means wealth, and therefore wealth is inherently evil. Clymer argues that mammon refers to the destructive use of wealth. Money, ambition, and business are just tools.
That makes sense.
The commandment to render unto Caesar is taken very literally. Here, you are obligated to fulfill your earthly duties with excellence, just as you serve God.
So what does this actually look like for the listener on a Tuesday at the office? What does a failure of this balance look like, practically?
A failure of balance goes both ways. If you sacrifice your physical health, your peace of mind, or your family to build a ruthless corporate empire, you have failed spiritually. Your algorithm is corrupt.
Right, we've established that.
However, and this is where he challenges a lot of modern spiritual seekers, if you ignore your bills, perform poorly at your job, or fail to provide for your dependents because you're too busy meditating or reading philosophy, that is equally a spiritual failure.
Oh, wow.
You are ignoring half of the equation you were placed here to solve.
That brings it right down to earth. Crunching numbers in a spreadsheet, dealing with a difficult client, or firing an underperforming vendor with dignity, those aren't distractions from your spiritual work. They are the laboratory.
Exactly. Conducting your daily business with honesty, fairness, and a genuine spirit of service transforms ordinary, mundane labor into what Clymer boldly calls the highest form of prayer.
Doing your job well is a prayer.
Yes. You bring divine law into the mundane.
If the 9-to-5 job is the laboratory, and our daily actions are the prayers, then our own physical and mental selves must be the ultimate sacred space.
Yes, that is the natural conclusion.
And Barron highlights Clymer's ultimate vision, which he calls the individualized church Christic. Now, for a secular or modern listener, that phrase is loaded with heavy traditional baggage. How do we translate that into something actionable?
Stripped of the 20th century esoteric terminology, the individualized church Christic is a state of profound psychological and spiritual integration. It means that true spirituality is never going to be found by joining an external institution, adhering to a dogma, or sitting in a pew hoping someone else does the work for you. The goal is for the individual human being to become the living temple.
So what does this all mean? It means you don't need to look outside yourself for a sacred space. Your moral integrity is the foundation, your disciplined thoughts are the walls, and your awakened heart is the altar. You are the building.
Beautifully put. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this transformation is what Clima calls the new order of the ages.
A societal shift.
Precisely. A societal shift that only happens when individuals first govern themselves through divine law. When your mind is disciplined through formology. When your daily actions are governed by purified desires. And when you achieve that equilibrium between your material responsibilities and your spiritual growth, the dormant acorn fully activates.
The human ego and the divine spark integrate.
Seamlessly. And the listener transitions from a son of man into a son of God. You transition into an entity that governs itself entirely by its own awakened inner law.
It's an incredibly demanding map for life. There are no shortcuts, and there's no one else to blame if the building falls apart.
No, the responsibility is entirely yours.
Let's synthesize this for the listener who is about to transition out of this audio and back into their day. We've explored the premise that you are carrying a dormant divine spark. You aren't fundamentally broken. Your mind is the architect, feeding inputs into that self-reinforcing algorithm of thought, desire, and action.
And we've examined how crucial it is to never suppress your darker passions, but to act as an alchemist, transmuting the heat of anger or frustration into constructive virtues.
Right.
And most importantly, we established that you do not need to retreat from the world to do this. The friction of your daily commute and your career is the exact crucible required to forge this inner temple.
But as Barron points out in The Temple Within, simply knowing the architecture doesn't build the house. This map is useless if left unread. The tools are completely available to you, and Clymer insists that even small, consistent daily efforts in shifting your mental tracks will yield massive results. But the door to this inner temple is unlocked, and the choice to cross the threshold is entirely yours.
The laboratory is always open.
Clymer tells us that every single thought, every transmuted frustration, and every honest business dealing is a brick used to construct your own living temple. So as you take off your headphones and step back into the friction of your day, what kind of room did you just build for yourself over the last 15 minutes?